geopolitical commentator and investigative journalist. You're listening to Pella Nuroff-Taylor on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome back to the second hour on this Friday afternoon on the Pella Nuroff-Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. We've got two excellent guests. Fiorella Isabella is an American journalist, correspondent, and geopolitical analyst. They're currently working out of Moscow, but traveling widely, and we'll ask her, I'll pass by some of my thoughts about whether Ukraine is heading for peace or not to her, and I'll get her response of what the Russian leadership might be thinking, where they're going. We've got Eric Andersson, a Swedish engineer, and our second guest for this second hour, who has news of an interesting development. He's followed this case closely, the Nord Stream case, which is going to the High Court in London, and he thinks there could be clues that he's unearthed in the court case that could blow open the whole Nord Stream issue. But we're going to talk about more lighthearted things on this final monologue of the week. ABBA, not just, there is a news angle, which is that Sweden, or rather the town of Malmo in the south of Sweden, is going to host the Eurovision Song Contest, I think, which Australia participates in. So it's not all European. I don't know, since when was Australia part of Europe? There you go. It's a huge event for Europeans. It's practically the only thing that's non-American that kind of unites us. I think it's incredibly tacky or whatever, but I mean, a lot of people like it and it's fun and so on. ABBA, so it's taking place in Malmo. Malmo, of course, is probably Northern Europe's most Muslim city. It's like the Marseille of the North, very heavily ethnic. And at the same time, the Eurovision Song Contest, which excluded Russia a few years ago after the invasion of Ukraine, has kept on Israel, despite everything that's going on in Gaza. And there's a young woman who's going to sing her song about peace and love and so on. And we can surely expect there to be riots, if nothing else. And so that's going to be the next twist of the Middle East Muslim versus Jewish conflict playing out elsewhere. But the ABBA said, I said I was going to talk about ABBA. Well, ABBA are going to open up a couple of museums and host a couple of shows in Malmo to coincide with Eurovision Song Contest, because famously 50 years ago, this wonderful supergroup won the Eurovision Song Contest with their song Waterloo. Let's hope this does not Waterloo for the Eurovision Song Contest in 2024. Anyway, I just want to say to those of you who didn't know, it's interesting. I mentioned ABBA to some of the studio people and to my producer, and it was smiles all around. And I have to say that it's probably Sweden's premier artistic achievement in history. I mean, there's a lot of things to criticize about this country, the social conformism and the taxes and the sense of entitlement among an elite class based in Stockholm. But there's a fantastic music scene, which is grounded in actually the rural roots of most Swedes. There are lots of rural choirs. And the Swedish language itself is a kind of sing-song, which lends itself to singing. So ABBA was sort of just at the top of the pyramid of a very strong music culture that goes down the centuries, with violins and sort of fiddle music playing at Midsummer's Eve, that sort of thing. And Benny Andersson was a musical genius, of course, and I think nearly every person can mention 5 or 10 ABBA hits, which they'll secretly be humming along to. Agneta Svenskog was not just a dumb blonde, although she was salivated after by Anglo males on her tours. She was married, but she was a huge contributor to their music, and I can tell because once they split, divorces happening about the same time. The boys carried on working together, and it just wasn't the same without the women. They did the musical Chess, which was quite good, and they've been working up through this decade. And it's just, they're good, but it's not the same as ABBA. There were some magical agreements, two women, two men, two couples married to each other. And there's a small personal interest there, because my mother, who's also called Agneta, she's Swedish and she was blonde, and she went to London in the 1960s and 70s. And they often thought she was ABBA's lead singer, also called Agneta. I just want to say one last thing. So, current Sweden, I mean, this is also a memory of a Sweden that in a way that's passed away, because whenever I see a video of ABBA and some of the music, there's a popular trend of adding ABBA music to home videos of the old Sweden, which was you know, all white and stable and so on. And these videos on YouTube, if they're not taken down by YouTube, get hundreds of likes and comments in Swedish saying, well, Sweden ain't what it used to be. And indeed it isn't, because the news coming out of Sweden, of course, is that Sweden has the highest gangland shooting figure in Europe. They've just started up the 20 or 25% of the population is foreign born, and a lot of failed integration going on. There's a kind of hybrid youth culture. If you go to any school, it's not a white country anymore. You can download a 112 app. 112 is the emergency number in Europe. That 112 app will give you a list of the latest shootings and explosions. There are far more shootings and explosions than actual killings. All the murder rate isn't that high. It's the high end of the European scale, but it's much lower than the United States. I mean, let's get it right. But there are a lot of explosions and shootings as the gangs shoot at each other mostly and don't cross the line, as it were. But it's very intimidating for the average population. So we will see whether this Sweden is where, I mean, I've long wondered whether Swedes are ever going to stand up and protest against the changes that have happened in their country. And I just want to end on one last thing, which is that there's a popular meme circulating in Sweden. They use the English language for this, and they say Swedish ass 1974, and they have a picture of Agneta Fältskog's beautiful behind, and then Swedish ass 2024, and then a picture of the current Swedish prime minister, whose name escapes me. He's a completely anonymous figure. Anyways, we're going to go into our more serious news now with our very serious political editor, Basil Valentine, after a very quick break. This is the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on Friday afternoon.
Getting straight to the facts.
Enough with the lies. We need facts.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show. We've got Basil Valentine with serious news and serious talk, because we're always serious, aren't we, Basil?
Always very serious, Pelle, yes.
You've heard of ABBA, haven't you?
Just about, yes. I loved them, and for many years I clung to the belief, the hope, that Sweden was unchanged since those, you know, Volvo, ABBA, Halcyon days of the 1970s, where Sweden also was famous, of course, in Britain for its lax pornography laws, blue movies.
That's right. That's right.
All sorts of erotica was for some reason associated with Sweden. Well,
I know.
Sweden has just lowered the gender reassignment age in a controversial new law. So there's still some of the extreme liberal madness around. You can apparently now change gender, if you believe such a thing is possible, reassign your gender from the age of 16 under new rules, which also make access to surgical interventions easier. Okay. Yeah. On top of that, also coming out of Sweden today, three people are injured in a suspected knife attack in central Sweden, which is, I believe, where you are, in Västerås just this afternoon. Several women described as elderly were found injured with stab wounds. I very much doubt they did it to each other. And finally, while we're still on Sweden, heightened security as police fear terror attacks in Malbo, as the Eurovision Song Contest, of course, where Israel's participation is the cause of considerable controversy. Though I think the whole framing of that terror attacks is designed to once again deflect from the real crime, which is the fact that Israel is taking part at all. Mm. So feel free to pick up any one of those.
I was going to say, I mean, Sweden is not, in some ways, it's a funny country. I mean, if you come to Sweden, you'll feel that you'll feel freer. And I never thought I'd say this, because I was really sort of in my younger self was kind of convinced that the UK was the bastion of freedom and Sweden was egalitarian, but sort of semi-totalitarian. That's completely wrong. I think I feel quite free in Sweden. On the topic, I mean, there's a strong feminist movement. So, like prostitution and pornography, I mean, it's just a no-no. So that was a brief 70s period. But I remember going I lived most of my life in London, going to phone boxes in London, those red phone boxes, and it was plastered with Swedish girls, you know? And this was like up into the 90s. So the myth lasted longer than the reality, because this free pornography only lasted about 10 years, you know, and you had hundreds of brothels in Stockholm. You had really violent and outre pornography in every single newsstand. And I was too young, but it was like early 70s. And then they actually banned prostitution in Sweden. And it's these laws that I think Scotland and the more progressive parts of the UK have adopted now. So you criminalize the guy who uses the prostitute, but not the prostitution itself. He's seen as a victim. And it's put a dampen. I mean, there's a kind of strong, people in Sweden constantly debate things like sex and consent. You know, that's the big thing about the Julian Assange case. It was like Swedish third wave sort of bossy feminism contra, you know, Australian laddishness, if you like, in a way. But I was going to say about the Malmo, because I spent a couple of years in Malmo. My mum went back there when my parents separated, and I went through high school, lower school, 3 years of the lower high school. And so pretty significant years. But I remember that the Malmo was always proud of its Jewish reception, because during the war, many, many Jews fled to Sweden from the continent, and they settled in. They came to Malmo because the first port of call is just across the straits from Copenhagen, which is four kilometers at its narrowest point in Helsingborg. So you could see across to the other side. And I think the Germans looked the other way, and many Jews came there. And then in 1945, the Swedes sent down these buses to rescue Jews from Dachau and Auschwitz, and not Auschwitz, the German ones, the Bergen-Belsen, I think maybe. Anyway, that's part of the Swedish myth law about being welcoming to refugees. And my mum's first memory, she was born in 1941, was seeing these hungry, starving Jews coming to Sweden. And so Sweden, Niels Bohr was a famous Danish Jew, obviously a physicist, Nobel Prize winner, did a lot on the Manhattan Project, atomic bomb, and quantum physics. He came on shore. So as a lot of Jews came to Malmo, and they settled in Malmo, and Sweden sort of atoned for its neutrality in World War II, if you like, by being a haven for persecuted people. And for many Swedes, Europeans, it really was paradise. Sweden was very rich for 20 or 30 years, even 40 years after the war, you know, paradise on earth for many. And now it isn't. Now it's like a mid-ranking European country. But now, of course, Malmo's Jews have all left because they're being persecuted, you know. And I remember my mum's doctor.
Hold on a moment. Malmo's Jews are being persecuted. Who by?
That's by the Muslim population.
Right. So there's a large influx of Muslims into Malmo who've driven the Jewish community.
That's
out.
Right. More or less. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And when did this all start?
So you can distinguish Israel's policies from you know, the status of Jews. So I think there are like 200 left. And I did part of my documentary about Malmo, covered the Jewish issue. And there's been some Swedes have talked about it. They say, well, we were a haven for persecution, and now it's terrible to be a Jew in Malmo. So they basically, nearly all of them have left. They've gone to Israel or somewhere. So there you go.
It's ironic because there were members of the Jewish community in Sweden who were calling for multiculturalism to become the norm. So it looks like that backfired, doesn't it?
Exactly. Absolutely. I mean, there's a whole thing about, you know, that Jews want immigration because it means that they're less of a minority. I mean, there's this thing you could talk about that partly maybe because they're better educated or whatever. And a lot of Jews in places like Sweden tend to be in the media elite. And so they're less affected by the consequences of their policies. And they're quite left liberals, if you were. And they live in Stockholm. And so they've long stood in Sweden for a very liberal immigration policy. And it's kind of coming back in a way to affect them because Muslim anti-Semitism. I mean, it's almost a topic that you can't mention because what the mainstream media, I mean, in Sweden, they're completely dishonest. I mean, they're really worthless. I wouldn't waste 5 minutes on them. Almost everything they say is wrong. I mean, they don't understand the world situation one bit. I mean, but there's still this narrative going on that the Swedish, I mean, the Swedish media elite admits that the Jews are for some reason leaving Malmo in specifically and leaving Sweden in general. I think they're clustering in Stockholm, where they find a better reception, because Stockholm, being the capital, has taken in fewer Muslim immigrants than anywhere else, because, you know, that's the way it is. And but they're still saying that, well, it's the far right in Sweden, it's the Nazis. But there are no Nazis in Sweden, honestly. I mean, you know, I've never seen any young men in jackboots or threatening clusters of, it just doesn't exist. It does not. I mean, the Swedes are probably the male, Swedish males, if anything, they suffer a huge masculinity deficit. You know, it's not that type at all. So I think they're bigging up something. I mean, there's a lot of people who are unhappy about immigration, and they're kind of good old boys. They're a lot of rednecks, if you like, but they're not Nazis, not organized Nazism. Even during the war, the Nazis only got 1 or 2% of the vote, and the Swedes were very proud of that, because ditto in Denmark, incidentally, which was an occupied country by the Germans. Nazism is not a Scandinavian thing, not at all. So obviously, but the obvious topic is that there's a lot of Muslim anti-Semitism. But so, you know, there you go. I'm thinking possibly of going down to Malmo in 2 weeks' time to follow up this story, at least go over the weekend. Because there are
huge protests planned at Israel's inclusion in the Eurovision. So it promises to be quite a spicy affair, put it that way.
Yeah. Well, and Eurovision has become incredibly political. And as you know, it's a sort of key event. I mean, I remember the Eurovision of the 1980s with Terry Wogan making fun of it, and it was ridiculous. And it was one of the things I loathed about Sweden, that the Swedes took it so seriously, and the whole country closed down. I thought it's just a bloody music festival, you know, and everyone was sitting there with their bags of crisps. And, you know, I thought, this is the pits, you know, give me London or something, give me New York. But it's kind of morphed into this event that's a mega event, hasn't it? Everyone votes politically for their favorite country. So the Greeks vote for the Cypriots and vice versa. And Israel, it's quite a good song, actually, the Israeli entry. Will it get null points, or will it get some kind of sympathy vote?
That would be very interesting to see. Yes.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah. Malmo will certainly be, as said. I'm repeating myself. But my mum's doctor was Jewish. She was chased around the place. She was in her 60s. She was making a demonstration, I think. I can't remember. Back in 2009. And she came up to my mum's flat, and I was visiting my mum at the time, and she was kind of in tears. And I felt incredibly bad about it, I have to say, you know, because there were young men who'd young Muslim men who'd given her a lot of grief. So, you know, and then she left for Israel, I think, after that, having been kicked out of Poland in 1968, because she was originally Polish, because the Polish communist government had its anti-Semitic purge in 1968. So I could see the Jewish perspective of always not having a home, not feeling safe anywhere. And, you know, being... but as you said, I mean, there's a lot of pro-immigration sentiment. There's a famous video with Barbara Spector, who name Spector is a kind of, you know, it evokes satanic forces, doesn't it? Because it's the name of a James Bond villain.
Exactly. Yes.
And she was saying, "Well, Europe needs to be mixed up because Christian fanaticism or something needs to be dealt with.
Yeah, that's Europe's, right.
Europeans need this; they deserve this." You know.
That's right. Yeah, quite bizarre stuff, really. Mm.
And of course,
I think we're going to go to a break, Pelle.
All right. Okay. We'll carry on. On Monday, there'll be no dramatic developments at the weekend. The Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. Good to have you on, Basil, as always. We'll be back after the break.
TNT's Kate Shimarani.
And I got this one thing, and I thought, oh, it's because I'm a woman. No, there was a bloke came behind me with one thing, and they went, please, go ahead of us. And I said, fellas, this is fabulous. I just don't see people do this anymore. And they weren't British. I said, where are you from? And one of them said, we're from Albania. He said, we're not criminals. We're just people, we work. But people say such bad things about us. Please, we're not bad. And I said, well, listen, I don't look at you and think you're a criminal because of your accent. I said, do I look like a criminal? They went, no. I went, well, I am convicted. And I said, by most of the criminals in their uniforms working for the government, the tyrannical government.
Kate Shimarani on today's News Talk TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
The impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies. Because when people are fed, futures are nourished. Everyone deserves to live a full life. And with your help, together we can end hunger. Join the movement at feedingamerica.org/act now.
CO2 sustains all life on Earth, but now it's in long-term decline. We face the return of an ice age. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon in spring. We're very pleased to have with us a very well-known correspondent, Fiorella Isabel, who's an American journalist, correspondent, and geopolitical analyst who's traveled around the world and done reports which are very insightful and independent-minded. She has a lot of guests on. She works, I think, for RT in Moscow, and I think that's the place where she might be right now. So what I'm hoping to do is to bring the insights she gets from her independent investigative reporting and her anti-imperialist perspective and open mind to our discussion today, which is going to be about current affairs related to Ukraine and Israel-Iran. Welcome to the show, Fiorella.
Thanks for having me.
I'm just wondering whether I was there was an interesting article by Seymour Hersh, who is this independent, very famous American journalist, has contacts with the CIA and the Pentagon. He is banned by the New York Times, the New Yorker, but he's like America's top correspondent now in his 80s. But he's a fantastic correspondent. He said this whole Israel kind of theater, if you like, was coordinated between the Russians and the Americans. Do you have any information about that from your side or any coverage of that? And does that sound plausible?
I think he has done great work throughout his lifetime, but I haven't actually heard of anything like that. I think what's been happening right now between Israel and Iran is a long time coming, and everybody has seen it in terms of the United States' attempts at expanding its influence in the region, which is the precise reason for the existence of Israel. And Hersh has a lot of contacts, like you mentioned, in the CIA and the Pentagon. And I suspect those contacts do relay information that is limited to a certain degree and a certain scope and a certain perspective. So I think that's where that's coming from. I don't really see this as any sort of fake war scenario. I see it as the reality that's really been just building up for a very long time. When you talk about Gaza and what's happened there, that's been ongoing for 70 plus years of just fighting. And it's involved England, it's involved the UK, it's involved other nations as well. It's not just been Palestine involved, it's been the United States. And when you see today that the United States blocked the ability for Palestinian territory to be recognized, and they were the only ones that did, and two were abstained, but that just shows you really what is going on here. When people tout the two-state solution, there is no two-state solution then if you're saying you don't even want the establishment of a Palestinian state.
Do you think Israel, though, has been weakened by what's the situation now? Because they're making these commitments in Gaza. They realize that a lot of the world hates them. They realize that Iran is ultimately got a lot of support from China and Russia and maybe other powers. And they know that Iran has weapons, non-nuclear, but for sure, but can really devastate Israel. And there's a theme. I talked to somebody who'd just been to Israel. She's very pro-Israeli. She just got back. She said Israelis are kind of, there's a sense of loss. They feel that they've lost this. Is that what you feel? Is that what the reporting's coming out of Russia? The feels where you are? Is that coming in the same direction? Coming from the same direction?
I think I would agree with her actually on probably on just that point. I do think Israel has lost, and I think the entire world sees it, and they have lost in different ways. They've lost, obviously, the popular vote of the people, the confidence, the empathy of the people in what everybody has seen in their phones, on their camera, on their phones, in their computers, on their TV screens of what's been done to Gaza. But also militarily, if you look at what was done in Gaza, and also I just came back from the occupied West Bank where people live in apartheid because Israel controls every checkpoint, every sort of center of movement for these people that live there. If you look at all of that, Israel hasn't achieved any substantive military objectives where you can say that, oh, look, they've conquered this, they've defeated this. The only thing they have to show for is the death of 33,000 plus people. And the entire world has seen that. So I agree, Israel has lost. And I think Iran's attack and Israel's supposed response by using basically drones that got shut down that were really a nothing burger really shows who has the power here. And as you mentioned, Russia and China, well, the Russian delegation at the UN Security Council walked out as well. They've walked off. The relationship, I think, between Russia and Israel is shifting because Israel is putting so much pressure and damage on the region, and Russia has acted, as well as China to a degree, as a neutral diplomatic entity in the region.
Yeah. Fiorella, we're going to go to sort of every half hour we have a news break of a minute. So I'll latch onto that idea, the Russian-Israeli relationship, which seems shifting, as you say. There's a lot of support, a lot of Russian Jews living in Israel. So very complicated relationship between those two. Then we'll talk about Ukraine, of course. But that's after the news break. So this is the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon with Fiorella Isabel, an American journalist and commentator. Back after the break.
Here's the news.
TNT Radio News.
TNT, this is James O'Neill. Israel launched airstrikes on Iran early on Friday, following Iran's attack on Israel with drones and missiles last week. Ukraine lacks an alternative strategy for its conflict with Russia if the U.S. fails to approve additional military aid, according to Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmitry Kuleba. Sam Salapour, a Boeing engineer, testified before two U.S. Senate committee hearings, warning that unresolved safety issues at Boeing could lead to catastrophic airplane failures.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon. We've got Fiorella Isabel, an American journalist and investigative reporter who brings an anti-imperialist perspective and an open mind to her coverage of world issues. And we were just talking about the Russian-Israeli relationship, which appears to be shifting. Can you tell us where that relationship was a few years ago and where it's heading to in the next year or so?
Right. So as you mentioned earlier on, Russian and Israeli relations have been somewhat of in a neutral aspect. Russia has tried to act as a mediator in the region, but Russia has strong allies in Syria and in Iran as well. So it has been an interesting relationship. There are autonomous Jewish regions in Russia. There are a lot of Russian Israelis, several of them living right now in Israel. And I did get a sense of that when I was there as well. So that relationship, I think that has been somewhat open is shifting towards Russia trying to hold Israel accountable for what it's done. They've obviously denounced what has been done in Gaza, but far beyond that, Russia has been supporting the establishment of a Palestinian state. They, along with China and other diplomatic powers, have been pushing for a two-state solution wherein there will be the establishment of a Palestinian state and an Israeli state that would live in harmony. But the reality is, clearly, the United States doesn't want that. Israel doesn't want that. Their goal is to expand further into Lebanon, into Syria, into Jordan, into basically the entire region. And so because that is their intent, and we have seen the attacks as well on the embassy, the Iranian embassy in Damascus, Syria. That was, I think, a turning point for Russia, because they are very, very akin to the international law, to humanitarian law. And that was a violation of the Vienna Convention. It was a violation of international law. They are very much pro diplomacy first. And that's what we've seen throughout this whole Ukraine situation. And so when Israel did that, it was a clear sign that they don't want to cooperate in this way. And so we saw now the delegation leave the room. We saw the United States come out against the establishment of the Palestinian state. And Russia, of course, criticized the Israel and their Western powers for doing this. And this is, again, just a shift that we're seeing. And I think it's going to come to a point, and I've said this before, where Russia has to make a decision, because it seems like this is escalating further and further. And if Israel does attack Iran, Iran has said they will come back tenfold. And I don't have any reason to think that they are lying this time around.
So, but do you think that we're out of the woods for the moment with the Israel sending in some drones and Iran saying, okay, we're not going to counterattack? Or do you think we could see yet another escalation, maybe after Passover or something? What's your instinct or your sources telling you?
I think Israel is going to actually attack. I think this is more of a probe that they were doing, some sort of instigation. I think they are going to try something. I think the United States will try to use them and use any sort of proxies before they get involved, perhaps a false flag scenario in order to get involved. Because if the United States gets involved, Iran will come back and attack anybody that is involved. And of course, that escalates everything into a global conflict that they don't want. And so I think the United States is holding out because there's an election coming and Joe Biden is an extremely weak candidate, extremely unpopular, and nobody really believes in him, especially young people. So I think that we're going to see is holding back on that. And Israel will act if they feel like they have the support of the West.
Fiorella, unfortunately, we've only got 2.5 minutes left on this particular interview, but could you just say some words about where you think Ukraine is going? Because I keep on it. I read TASS every day because, you know, it's part of one's duty, and RT for that matter, very interesting website. I don't listen to the show so much, but you get a lot of these peace feelers and you wonder how serious are they? And are they just, are the Russians sending out peace feelers, which are kind of being ignored by the West, or are they just padding it to make the global South thinking the Russians are serious about peace? Because there was a quote by on Lavrov on TASS today saying, well, we're going to carry on, you know, we're not going to stop our war if there's an Istanbul-type conversation again about peace, which if you can read it as, well, actually, we are open to peace, but just don't expect us to be taken in again as we were before, and we will continue advancing. How serious are the Russians now about peace? Big question, and you've only got a minute to answer, but there you go.
Yeah, I think that the real question to ask is how serious are Ukraine and the U.S. and their NATO contingent about peace, because this is already a done deal. Russia has effectively won. Ukraine has lost a lot of territory, lost hundreds of thousands of people, of young people, soldiers, of family men. Their economy is in the tank. Ukraine will never be the same again. And so who needs to actually stop this and stop the death? It's Ukraine and NATO. Russia has always pushed for peace and diplomacy. But again, they actually want to be invited in the room when you're talking about peace. They don't want to be excluded. And so I think that was Lavrov's point. Like, we're not going to stop until we have full security guarantees that you are actually going to stop threatening us and attacking us and threatening us with actual troops on the ground. They have kicked the football too many times. And I think that hopefully they finally learned their lesson.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that my feeling is, I just, you know, you read a hell of a lot and then you try and make your own impressions. And it's essential to read the Russian sources. And my feeling, and from talking to a lot of guests on this show, is that the Russians are not particularly in a hurry to take Kiev and Odessa, and maybe not even Kharkov. They'd be happy with the Donbass. And they want this security guarantees nailed down. They do not want Ukraine in NATO. But I mean, as for even taking Odessa, I don't feel that they even particularly want that. They just want the West to come to their senses, and they're going very slow. And the problem is, of course, the Western hawks are saying, holding up Russian restraint as evidence of Russian weakness, which is disastrous, of course, because Russia is not weak. Russia is very strong. And but I think on the other hand, I mean, there's a lot of Western sources now. People are waking up. People are watching Mearsheimer and TNT and RT via the VPN. And even in some of the mainstream, American press is much more open than the British press. The British press, for them, it's still 1938, you know, Hitler's coming sort of thing. But we can hope. But I get the feeling the Russians are taking it very slow. Anyway, Fiorella, I wish you I hope you can come on again, and I wish you best of luck in your reportage. And you can follow you on Twitter, and I think you have an RT show, Reading the News there. Thank you very much for coming on the show, and we've got to transition to our next guest. Thanks a lot. This is the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on Friday afternoon.
Thank you.
The challenges our planet's animals are facing sometimes feel a bit heavy.
The animals haven't eaten in a day, 2 days, they haven't drank anything. They're cold, they're dehydrated.
As soon as we started our descent, everywhere I could see was mud, just absolutely mud.
So the country has been in prolonged drought so long, it was like a tinderbox waiting to go up.
Okay, very heavy. Each of us wants to be part of the solution, and we can be. Remember that there's good happening right now. At home.
All right, we were able to get into your unit, and we have all four of your cats. So,
okay.
And around the world. For any animal in any disaster. So let's focus on that, right? Be part of the solution, one rescue at a time. Search ifa.org/disaster-ready.
Hi, I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you out, because only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, Assistant Smokey Bear, call me Papa Bear, because I'm grilling up dinner. Do you get it?
Yes, good job.
So, what should I do with all these coals?
Don't just toss them out. Put them in a metal container, because those embers can start a wildfire.
I understand. The stakes are high.
Ha 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 ha.
See, Smokey thinks I'm funny.
Discussing national and international issues. You're listening to Pelle Neroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show. We're going to talk a little bit about Nord Stream with Erik Andersson, a former engineer at Volvo and Boeing, now investigating Nord Stream from his base in Gothenburg in Sweden. He's got a background which he says is excellent for this purpose of finding out what really happened. He's worked a lot with mission planning software, criminal investigations into drone surveys and satellite image analysis. He's also experienced in media politics relations and is an amateur interest in geology, which helped him when speaking to seismologists. He knows one of Sweden's best divers, and together I think they carried out a mission near the Nord Stream explosions, which took place in September 9, 2022, which involved a boat. And he's got some new information, which acquired in a very short time 446,000 views. And that was to do with the insurance case that is being developed here in the High Court in London, and which could bring us more information about who did this attack. Welcome to the show, Erik. What's going on?
Well, apparently it was a huge interest when Lloyd's, the big insurance company, put in their defense in this suit, this lawsuit that the Nord Stream AG had filed. And the defense said that they didn't want to pay because it was a government that either did it or ordered it to be done. I mean, the bombings of the Nord Stream were ordered by a government. And it was a bit of a surprise,
So basically, back in 2000, or let's say last year, Lloyd's, which is the world's largest insurer and an essential part of the City of London and many contacts inside what you call the British deep state or whatever, very famous well around the world. They pay out insurance money for everyone. And I think they've paid out more in recent years because of a year of disasters. They said, no, we can't pay out because there's a provision in the contract that says that we don't have to pay out in the case of war or an invasion or several. There's a long list of things, but anything involving a sovereign government's attack on these pipelines.
Well, not everything involving it, not everything involving a sovereign government attack, because before they made this filing, we had already read the claimant's document, and the claimant's document were citing a paragraph that showed that they actually did have cover for terrorism.
And so just the claimants aren't Nord Stream, right? Okay. Nord Stream and their lawyers, just in brackets, because people forget all these things all the time. Yeah, carry on. Continue.
Yeah. Nord Stream. Yeah. So they seemed very confident that they would win this because they cited the language in the policy and that brought up acts of terrorism using weapons of war, explosives, whether or not this was done by agents of a sovereign state. So I thought they were covered. I thought this is crystal clear. But then there is this other paragraph that they didn't mention, but which the insurance companies brought up, which says that if any of these things are done by a government, then the terrorist clause does not apply. I mean, we can talk about why this happened, but it's absolutely clear. I talked to a legal scholar about this, and he says that the insurance companies have the burden of proof. They must prove that it was a government, and then obviously they also have to say which government it was. So I just guess that's probably
summarize. They're basically, both sides are kind of cherry picking what is, like all contracts are. I mean, we're talking about huge sums there, and as anyone who knows a legal contract with the clever lawyers, they are written in legalese and they refer back to clauses and you have to go back to the original and so on. I had a look at it this morning. Basically, part of the document says that you can get compensation for terrorist attacks, regardless if it's a sovereign state behind or not. And another part of the document, or the clause just above, says, well, no, you don't have to pay if a government ordered it. And the both sides, the Lloyd's side, who doesn't want to pay out, are referring to the government clause saying, well, it was a government, thereby implying that it was a government involvement. And the company, the claimants, that is Nord Stream, who want their $400 million for this destroyed thing, are pointing in a slightly different document, part of the document. And you can discuss those things endlessly, and it probably will come up in the court. But you're sort of saying that, well, the Lloyd's have pointed this out. So what does Lloyd's and their lawyers in London know what the rest of us don't? And what are they going to have to do to avoid paying out $400 million when it comes up to the High Court in London, which is a commercial court?
Well, you probably know that more than I do. But I mean, the rumors and previous reporting is saying that there is a revolving doors between deep state operatives. There was a previous MI6 director who's got the chief of Lloyd's or the insurance department, I think, at one point. So the assumption, and I see in a lot of the comments on my Twitter or X postings, many people are assuming that Lloyd's actually know more than they tell us.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I really don't know about this. What I know is that they do now have the burden of proof. So that sets up a game here. And maybe they are provoking some of their colleagues. That maybe there is another infighting going on about who is actually going to pay for this.
So they're going to have to prove somehow that to their satisfaction or to the world's satisfaction that a nation state was involved. And then they'll avoid paying out because it's force majeure or whatever you call it. And they'll save themselves and their investors, or whatever you call it, because Lloyd's is a kind of complicated structure where people can rich people normally can invest and, but then they can get stable money year after year, but suddenly they can find themselves on the hook for a large insurance claim and they spend that and they really get bankrupted. And it's happened in the past. It's a 300-year-old institution that's the centerpiece of the world insurance market and very important for British society and life. And they, you said they might know more, but they in a way, it's a kind of, if they push this, if the Lloyd's lawyers try and push the idea of American or British or Ukrainian guilt, they're not only offending parts of the British deep state, if you like, but they're also associating, because Lloyd's reputation is dependent on Britain's reputation as a country that does is like a sort of Switzerland, which we know it isn't, but basically a safe haven for money and an objective country that doesn't get involved in things, and where if you can insure your things with Lloyd's, they won't not pay out just because their government does bad things, right? They'll pay out regardless.
Yeah, there are some absolutely astonishing sections there in this filing that, to me, seems to put their reputation totally at stake. I mean, in the end, the final clause, they're saying that there might come sanctions in the future that is preventing them from paying out, which of course means that anyone who would sign up for insurance, they don't know if they're going to pay it out, because arbitrarily some sanctions may come, and then the contract will be violated. So they're not saying that they will even honor contracts that they had entered into. They are really just subject to this governments.
Because I don't know much about law, but I mean, you can't backdate backdate decisions, because what they didn't get Nord Stream 2. I mean, there were two pipelines that were blown up, Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2. Nord Stream 2 was hit by sanctions before it opened, and it never opened, of course. And Lloyd said, we're not going to insure that. But they did insure Nord Stream 1, which has been going for 10 years when there's relatively good relations between Russia and the West. And now they're saying, we're not even going to pay out for that, maybe. So even if the claimants win on the issue of the terror, whatever you call it, they have a second defense against paying up, which is that sanctions on Nord Stream 2 could be backdated to cover Nord Stream 1, which means that you can kind of backdate anything and use the sanctions law to get out of
payment. Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely astonishing. I mean, that clause, it means that they're completely, they're not following any like business ethical standards anymore.
Yeah, because the whole thing about if you are, and to me, it's like, the problem for the West at the moment is that a lot of our wealth is tied up in our credibility. And that is, people want to invest. People want to use the dollar because it's a currency that everyone can use. People park their money, their gold in the West. And this is the whole big debate about Russia. If they have their wealth confiscated, which is very tempting because you can use it to reconstruct Ukraine, $300 billion sitting in Western banks, then no developing country is going to do the same, because it could happen the same thing.
I think it's very, this is similar, what's happening here with the, it seems to happen with the insurance industry, might be similar to what's already happened to banking or part of the banking. Yeah.
So no one will use Lloyd's anymore because it's not a trustworthy, they're not true to their word, as it were. They're not reliable. So, but they must know this, don't you think?
Sorry?
The other thing that reminds me of it was that when the Russians started, their oil was banned from Europe. They started sending their oil to the global south, India and so on, and they used Russian supertankers. And then the governments of Britain said, well, Lloyd's won't insure you, and you have to insure your supertankers. But what the Russians did was just find someone else to insure them, and Lloyd's lost out. So we might see the development of new insurance companies. It's like the West is really, we're really shooting ourselves in the foot, because we're just seen as partisan fighters for our cause rather than objective powers that will guarantee everyone their wealth or whatever, or their compensation that they need. We're no longer neutral players. We're no longer objective. We're no longer seen as honest. We're just seen as partisan hacks, basically. And that's the danger I see.
Yeah, I mean, it would be welcome if other companies were able to develop in the West that could ignore the sanctions. But I'm not sure if that's possible, because the sanctions seem to be coming from left and right. Even if it's not written into law, I mean, these companies, both Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2, are Swiss companies, and it's not written into the Swiss law. Some of it is adopted in European law, but it doesn't apply to them. But it's still a big problem for Nord Stream, because any vendor, any subcontractor is afraid that they will be punished. So it's very difficult for them. It's very difficult for them to transfer money. It's very difficult to get IT support, because people are afraid that they will be losing business elsewhere if they are being naughty and doing business with Nord Stream.
Yeah. So the what do you think is going to happen then? We've got the Lloyds and their lawyers trying to get out of a $400 million payment by saying that there's a war clause, and they there's the one who want the money, the Nord Stream, saying, well, we're covered by the terror clause, even if it's a government backing the terrorist attack. And then you're saying that Lloyds and their lawyers need to prove that it's a government. But what if it's the Ukrainian government, which has sort of been the sort of happy medium for the mainstream media in the West? You know, it wasn't the Russians. No one's saying it's the Russians anymore. I mean, that's kind of out of the question. Even in none of these Lloyds documentation is talking about that. But I think it's a myth, because everyone can blame the Ukrainians. They're safe to blame because they're fighting for their lives and so on. And if they attacked it, well, you can understand them because they're not getting more help from us. Do you think Lloyds might end up proving that it was the Ukrainians?
Well, that's what I thought when I read the claimants document. I thought they would go with the Ukrainian narrative, because that's been emerging as the main mainstream explanation to what happened. It's that it was not directly a state action. It was some rogue individual, some lower level in the Ukrainian military, who planned this with a crew of commandos on a sailboat to place the bombs, etc. So I thought that was the way they would deal with it. They would say that this was a terrorist attack, and then they would pay out the money and make sure that no state got blamed. So I was actually quite surprised when Lloyds and ARC came back and said it was a government, we're not going to pay.
But so even blaming the Ukrainian government is okay from a political Western political point of view, because how will Ukraine won't suffer if they're blamed for the Nord Stream attack, will they? Apart from a loss of reputation, maybe.
Well, I mean, I'm not the one to answer these consequences. I'm amazed that Germany continues to send weaponry to Ukraine after this, after the German press has pointed out that this seems to be a Ukrainian operation.
Yeah, you're right. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, that's a good point. So it's a kind of German-Ukrainian issue, because Germany's seen its energy prices go up through the roof. And so they're saying, well, if you're doing this to us, why should we send you more money? And the Lloyds issue could confirm that in the German people's minds, I guess.
Yeah, it could perhaps in people's minds do so. This legal scholar I'm talking to, Said Mahmoudi is his name, he doesn't believe that the commercial court will sway the politicians. I think he has his grievances about previous similar cases where you actually have a working, you know, truthful process in the commercial court, but the politicians are still managing to ignore that and have their own truths, so to speak. But it appears unlikely to me. It seems unlikely because this is so high profile. It's such a big interest. So I don't understand how they could get away with it.
So, well, to summarize, because we're going to go into a break and then the next show host takes over. Erik Andersson has been studying this thing. He's sent a boat out. He's a highly skilled dissector of narratives and been going through the legal documentation of a case that from Nord Stream and their lawyers to say, well, we want our money, which Lloyd's refused, the large insurance refused to pay out up to $400 million because the Lloyd's said, well, it was an act of war by a state, and that means we're not covered. Well, Lloyd's are going to have to prove that. So the British establishment is going to go in to avoid paying out that money and actually determine which state did it, Ukraine or America or something like that, because no one's talking about Russia. And that could be a pressure point or a large public opinion loss for the West when it comes out, and maybe a loss of support for Ukraine, especially in Germany. Anyway, Erik Andersson, thank you very much. I'm sure you'll tell us about new developments, and we'll bring you on again. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon. Thank you very much, and see you on Monday.